This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Summertime movies are often big-budget action films or harmless comedies. One of the best films of the summer, One False Move, fits into neither category. It's the type of low-budget independent film that might have fallen through the cracks if not for several critics, including Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, who urged people to rush out and see it. Siskel called it a brilliant detective thriller that comes to town without any hype. Ebert said it belonged on the very short list of great movies about violent criminals. The story is about three drug-dealing killers. They leave six dead bodies in Los Angeles and head for a small town in Arkansas. The town sheriff is waiting for them. So are two detectives who have been sent from L.A. A little later, we'll meet the film's director, Carl Franklin. Joining us first is Billy Bob Thornton, who plays the most emotionally unstable killer. Thornton also co-wrote the script with Tom Epperson. Although the film evolves into a character study, the opening scenes are brutal and horrifying. Thornton told me about writing those scenes.
We actually got some people at the L.A. PD Homicide Division to give us an idea of what a real murder scene looks like and not a Hollywood murder scene. We looked at a lot of actual pictures of murder scenes and talked to a lot of police officers and even a few criminals. And what we wanted to do, because Tom and myself, we don't really like to condone violence, I mean, in movies. I know that sounds odd after you see this movie, you would never believe I would say that, but we wanted to show violence the way it really is. So that's the way we wrote the scene, was very, very simply, and it had to be brutal in order to show that violence is not fun. It's not like RoboCop or something. You know, in real life, violence takes place very quickly and methodically, and we wanted to get that across. As a matter of fact, we talked with Carl Franklin, the director, about that particular scene, those opening scenes, about how we wanted to make it look as if a news crew had just captured a real murder or mm-hmm. some real murders, and he had that in his head already.
The most brutal killer, the killer who is kind of like the intellectual of the group. You know, he mm-hmm. reads, he's really smart, but he has absolutely no heart and no soul, no conscience. And there's one scene in which he takes one of the women and puts a pillowcase over her head and then just stabs her in the heart. What made you think of doing the murder in that way?
We were told by someone that actually happened once to a person. So that was, we're not that twisted. We didn't dream that one up. That's something that we heard.
What stuck in your mind from the photos that you looked at and from what the cops told you about murder scenes?
Well, the aftermath of a murder looks very much like maybe a car running over a deer or a dog. You know how that looks? It's like it's just like, you know, an animal lying, bleeding in the road or something. I mean, people look the same way. That stuck out of my mind. I mean, when I would see someone on the floor in a pool of blood or whatever, with bruises or whatever on their face, it just looked like, I mean, I know this sounds horrible, but just like animal carcasses laying around. Mm-hmm. And that stuck out. And I never forgot that.
One of the real themes of your movie is the different relationships cops have with criminals in a small town than they do in a big city. You know, because you have the juxtaposition of the L.A. cops coming to this small town in Arkansas, and you know, meeting up with the sheriff of this small town, and the three of them, the two from L.A. and the one from Arkansas, are waiting for the three killers to come. And the way they see crime and the way they see criminals is so different. And I wonder what got you thinking about the different relationships cops have with criminals depending on the kind of size of the town. It being so much more of an impersonal relationship in a large town, and the small town, you know everybody.
Right. Well, it was what got me thinking about it was, or actually Tom and I are both from Arkansas, from a small town in Arkansas, and we've both lived here for several years, like 11 or 12 years. So we've seen both things. And, you know, when I came to L.A., I was amazed that cops were as cop-like as they are, because where I grew up, cops were just like these guys who happened to be in charge, you know. And so for me, I just saw it growing up. I saw small-town cops come over and get, you know, somebody's cat off the roof and that kind of thing. And every once in a while, there would be a murder. But when there was a murder, in my neck of the woods, it was such a big deal. You couldn't believe that it happened. I mean, it was so out of the ordinary. And out here, it's gotten to the point where we've become desensitized to murder. I mean, what with the gang problems and everything. And I actually was turning a corner in the middle of Hollywood on Sunset and La Brea and got involved in a shootout about a month ago at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. There were six or seven gang members in the middle of La Brea shooting at each other, and one actually used my car as a shield there for a minute before I made a dramatic U-turn. It wasn't even on television. I watched the news that night just to see if my particular shootout was on TV. But since no one was killed in it, and nobody captured it on videotape, it wasn't a big enough deal for them, I guess. If that happened where I grew up, it would be on every station for the next 6 months.
Now, how did being in the middle of the shootout affect your feelings about your movie, which is so much about violence, or, you know, just affect your feelings about violence? I mean, it's just like one thing to sit in a room and think and write about it, and another thing to be caught in the middle of it.
I've been caught in the middle of a lot of things in my lifetime, so it wasn't really like a new thing for me. I have a sordid past.
What are some of the elements of that?
In my younger days, I never killed anybody. That's what you're asking me. But I've been involved in various shady dealings, and I was a drug addict. Is actually what the deal was for several years.
Did you get involved in selling too?
Yes. And as a result of that, I was faced with a few sticky situations, you know. I mean, I had a couple of, I've had a few shooting irons pointed at me. So this thing was like, you know, while it wasn't new to me, I mean, it's always scary. I mean, you know, the adrenaline always starts pumping, but, you know, it wasn't like, wow, that's the first time I've ever seen a real gun, you know, or a real gangster. I've seen a lot of them.
One of the really, really most frightening things about drug-related violence is that if you're high on drugs, it's often the case that whatever conscience or heart you have is covered up, you know, and people just act more crazy than they would, and more unpredictably than they would, which is, I think, one of the things you're getting at in the movie, too.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think people are crazy to start with, and drugs just sort of unlock that, you know? I think drugs are a result of something much, much deeper seated, really. It was that way in my case, and I think it is in most people's cases, and definitely for the characters of Ray and Pluto in this movie. I mean, these people, drugs didn't mess them up. As a matter of fact, Pluto doesn't do drugs. You know,
That's right.
In the movie. My character did. He did that just because he wanted to. You know, it wasn't... and he did the things he did because he wanted to. My character actually, it's funny that you said that Pluto had no heart. You can tell that Ray's character actually does have heart, you know? I mean, it's a twisted heart, no doubt, and he's out of his mind, but he actually thinks he has a normal family life, you know, with his girlfriend there. The way they talk to each other, it's like I mean, at one point, I mean, in the movie, where I cut her a piece of apple and I try to give it to her on a knife, she takes it off like she doesn't want me putting it in her mouth. And she says, "I'm glad you didn't kill that man at the car lot." And I say, "What do you think we are?" It's a sincere thing, you know?
Right. It's like, yeah.
I mean, it's like, oh, we wouldn't kill the car lot guy. I mean, only those people back there in L.A. or anybody else who ever messes with me.
Right.
You know, I would never kill just some, you know, slob at a car lot.
Yeah, he has no idea how crazy he is.
No, he doesn't have a clue. And I think a lot of crazy people are like that.
So what kind of got you from that period of your life in which you were into using and dealing in from there into, like, acting and writing? Or were you doing both for a while?
Well, I was always sort of an artist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even through that stuff, I was a musician at the time. I used to be a rock and roll singer, and when I was doing that stuff, I was singing in a rock and roll band. So, what I'd always wanted to do since I saw my first my heroes were actually Elvis Presley and Andy Griffith.
Andy Griffith.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you notice, the Hurricane character, if you really look at it, is a little bit like Andy Griffith, you know? Sort of that, I mean, he carries a gun, obviously, but that the way he goes over to the guy's house and it makes him stop trying to break into the house with the axe and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an Andy Griffith thing. That's like Andy Griffith going over to settle down Ernest T. Bass, you know? It's he's a lot like Andy Griffith, and we actually talked about that. Sometimes Tom and I refer to the movie as Bonnie and Clyde meet Andy Griffith.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
Billy Bob Thornton stars in the new movie One False Move. He also co-wrote the film. His next good guy role on TV will be in a new Linda Bloodworth Thompson series called Hearts of Fire. He'll co-star with John Ritter. We'll meet the director of One False Move, Carl Franklin, after this short break. This is Fresh Air. One False Move, the film we've been talking about, was directed by my guest, Carl Franklin. If you don't recognize him, that's because most of his movies have been Roger Corman cheapies that Franklin is too embarrassed to mention by name. Yet the producer of One False Move, Jesse Beaton, recognized the potential in those films and hired Franklin. Now Franklin is shooting a mini-series for HBO that follows the life of one African-American family over the course of a weekend. He took time off from that shoot to talk with us about One False Move. Like the screenwriter Billy Bob Thornton, Franklin wanted the opening murder scenes to be as realistic as possible.
At different times, actors wanted to throw in little quips, you know, little lines that somehow were cute lines, you know, I guess you could say tantamount or inspired by lines like Make My Day and things like that, you know. And I feel that that kind of undercuts the seriousness of the situation. And I have never been in a violent situation or witnessed one where I saw somebody do that. And so I just didn't want that, for one thing. I wanted the actors to play, to commit emotionally to the moment. I felt that the honesty of trying to depict a real violent situation was necessary, and I also decided to shoot it from the point of view of the people as opposed to from some slick subjective point of view where you get inside and see, you know, opening flesh, slashing wounds, and, you know, here, you know, close-ups on necks popping and all of that kind of stuff. We stayed pretty wide so you could see 2-3 people at once. And in one instance, when the officer was killed, we went across the street and shot that very wide so you could see all 4 characters in that scene. And the police officer down by himself when all of the people drove off, to me, was a stronger image than if we'd gotten up close and, you know, shown brain splattering and that kind of thing. You know, we didn't see any of that or blood, but I think it was a strong moment because we saw the environment that had been violated and, you know, the way that people responded to it, I think, is, you know, really the violence.
In your life, did you have more experience with cops or with killers? Did you relate more to one set of characters than the other, or, you know, feel like you knew them better?
I kind of have had experiences with both, I guess. You know, I've known some killers. In fact, crime is kind of an interesting subject matter for me because I grew up in a city that has, like, one of the highest crime rates per capita in California. It's like only, 100,000 people in the town I grew up in, but it has like as many more murders than I think San Francisco, which is 4 or 5 times its size. And the interesting thing I've always found is I've been curious. You know, I knew guys that I had played baseball, football, and ran track with, and, you know, you're small, you're kids, and then you leave for 2 weeks on a vacation or something, you come back, the guy's in jail, and you never saw any evidence of him being a person capable of doing whatever it was that he did. And I've often wondered, you know, whether it is, you know, a set of circumstances that cause it, or whether it is something inside of somebody that's going to come out anyway. And so I guess, you know, I'm interested in what, you know, causes crime, because, you know, I've been around a lot of it. And I've also, I have a feeling that police officers and the criminals, maybe that what separates them is a very thin line, if not a dotted line in some respects. I think that they all are focusing on the same subject, which is crime. It's just that they find themselves on opposite sides of it. You know, but I think that, you know, there's not a lot of difference between the jailer and the jailed. You know, they're still in jail. You know.
Well, did you ever feel like you were getting drawn into the crime that was so prevalent where you grew up?
I felt that I could have been. You know, I kind of had a unique experience in a lot of ways, because I would find myself with a group of people, and I might turn right, you know, a block before they kept going straight, and then something bad happened. That happened to me throughout my youth. And I can't explain why that happened, you know. It's weird, but, you know, I didn't even realize that the place that I grew up in was as bad as it was until I went back after I'd moved away, you know, for several years. And, you know, I came back and realized, wow, it's bad, and it was bad then. The reputation that the town had didn't really present itself to me until I was, you know, long gone. It was just home for me when I grew up.
We're in a period where there's a lot of... or comparatively a lot of young African-American directors who are getting to make movies, and the movies are turning out to be very popular, which is leading, I think, to more work for young African-American directors, because I think the studios are starting to get more confident that films with black actors and black directors will make money. Is that helping you? Is that affecting you at all?
You know, I suppose in some respects I'm a beneficiary of that. I don't know. You know, it's interesting. My agent's getting a lot of calls now because of One False Move for, you know, future work. Half of those calls, those people don't even know that I'm black. A lot of the projects that are being sent me are projects that don't have black characters in them, and with fairly big name actors. Jesse, when she came to me, I don't think that she was looking for a black director. In fact, I think that in the canvassing she did for a director, most of those directors were white, I would believe. She was, you know, kind of, so I don't know how much I've benefited from it. Certainly, I don't think that had any effect whatsoever on why Roger hired me. I don't know that Roger has any particular consciousness about any of that stuff. You know, for him, he just wants you to go out, make a movie, bring it back so he can sell it. So I can't say at this point that it really has affected my career directly.
Now, before you started directing, you were acting.
Yes, I was.
What kinds of parts did you get as an actor?
I played a lot of doctors and cops. You know, there's do you ever watch In Living Color?
Oh, sure.
In Living Color has a little kind of skit they do on the sidekick.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Guy, I was that guy. You know,
right.
I was him, you know, for like about, in 3 different series, I was that man.
David Alan Grier plays that character.
David Alan Grier plays him, yeah. I played him for years.
So did you usually get killed?
No, but you know, it was interesting. I was doing a series once called McLean's Law with James Arness, and for 3 weeks in a row, I was getting beaten up every week. I was in a car. I was like Mr. Bill. You know, remember the guy on Saturday Night Live? They were doing all kinds of things where you squish him and whatever. You know, it's so funny because my daughter at that time was like 5 years old, and she noticed that this was the 3rd week in a row I'd gotten beaten up. And she said, they beat you up again, huh, Dad? I said, yeah. She says, you should let us come on TV so we can help you.
That's great. Yeah, the character of Sidekick from In Living Color, is he's always, you know, he's like the African-American sidekick to the white partner usually. So he's the one who plays it by the book. And
exactly, that was me.
And he's the one with no love interest.
Exactly. No love interest, no hint of, in fact, no interest at all other than the work. You know, you're not even, you don't, they don't even know what you do. You know, you don't leave, you don't even live anywhere. You know, you just exist in the office, in wherever the work takes place.
What often happens is as somebody's work starts to become better known and they become more successful, they get bigger budgets and then they get kind of caught into the Hollywood system. And sometimes that early vision that made their work so special is sacrificed because there's no room for it in the larger Hollywood system. How are you going to balance that in your career, do you think?
I'm dealing with that right now, as a matter of fact. I'm dealing with that right now because those opportunities are now real.
Yeah.
And it's scary because I got kids, you know?
Yeah, sure, and you want the best for them.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting? I actually found myself, it dawned on me, and I said it to Jesse about 3 weeks ago. I said, you know, there are a few directors, and I saw what happened to them. I don't want to name these guys, but I looked at their early stuff, and their stuff was wonderful. And it was edgy and, you know, personal, and, you know, their signature was written all over it. And now some of the big budget things they're doing look like something that any of 15 or 20 other directors could do. And I looked at that and realized these guys have probably made a conscious choice, because I don't believe that they forgot what they were doing early on. They made a conscious choice to do this, and it scared me for the first time. I don't know. You know, I at this point, I can say up to this point, the decisions I've made, I think, have reflected my own understanding of how protective I need to be of what I am. And somehow I think, in the long run, that even it will even be more commercially valuable for me to stick with what I am.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, I could get lost very easily, you know, if I started to conform too much to the convention. I think that, yeah, you may score a couple of times, but then, you know, I don't know what would make people want to come back and hire you if there's so many other people out there that can do the same thing.
Right. Well, I wish you the best. And
thank you.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Carl Franklin directed One False Move. It's now playing in 18 cities. It opens in New York and Washington on Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.